Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on NABBAclub.org, desperately in need, we're here, our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. We've got a very special speaker tonight, so special that we have to get somebody else to introduce her. Tinsley was in a recovery event recently on a Saturday. They shared the podium. He said, we've got to get Anna Kay here. So tell us more.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And I met Anna when we got to spoke at the, Celebration of Recovery Gathering, a.k.a. World's Longest Alcoholics Anonymous Meeting. It's a whole afternoon of speakers. But I thought, gee, we got to get her here to NABBA to speak because she just did a super job. And that was the 20-minute version. And so with that, I give you Anna Kay.
Hi, I'm Anna, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank Tinsley for inviting me tonight, and I'd like to thank NABBA for welcoming me. Actually, the celebration we were at was the North Atlanta Recovery Celebration. The acronym is NARC. And so that sort of put me at ease, and I was able to speak without a lot of self-consciousness. I heard Tinsley speak, and I said, oh, my gosh, we've got to get him at our meeting. I said, Tinsley, I'd like for you to share your story at our meeting. It's at 6:15 in the morning. He said, Anna, I'm a musician. You know, I barely have gone to bed before that. And he said, I'll do it. I said, great. He said, I'd like to ask you to speak at our meeting. I said, what time is it? He said, 8 p.m. I said, I'm an anesthesiologist. I go to bed at 8:30, but I'll stay up for you. I thought what I'd do tonight is, well, first of all, I'd like to just thank you for your attention. You know, it's real easy to get full of self-consciousness, self-centeredness, reference everything to myself. Why are all these people staring at me? You know, and I just have to get over myself. So I talked with my sponsor, and she said, you know, Anna, you're not there to impress anyone. So I just have to remember that. So I'd like to thank you for your attention. For those of you that are looking at me, I'd like to thank you for making eye contact and not, you know, picking your nails or otherwise looking disinterested. You know, the point is, I've tried to use the 12 steps to awaken to something so much bigger, you know, than Anna Kelly. And so I thank you for listening. I used to think that we were to tell what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now, and somebody corrected me and said, no, we're supposed to talk about what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And so what I'd like to do is tell you a little bit about my story so, as my sponsor said, y'all might be able to relate to me and know that I am a real alcoholic. But primarily I'm here to talk about the steps and how they've worked in my life to liberate me from 100 forms of fear and self. There has no amount of counseling, no amount of church, no amount of arguing with my husband. Nothing has been able to liberate me from the bondage of self other than the steps. And so I'm going to go through some pretty detailed talk about that. My sobriety date is July 7th, 1998. My sponsor's name is Paula. She's the second sponsor I've had in the 14 years I've been sober. My home group is, I'd like to correct Tim, he put on the sheet that it was the Dawn Busters, but no, it's the pre-Dawn Busters group at 8111. And he said it started at 6:45, but no, it starts at 6:15. So we'd love to have you. Tinsley's telling his story, I think, November 14th. We'd love to have you out there. It's just a great meeting. I find that people that come to meetings at 6:15 in the morning have either been up all night or they're pretty serious about their recovery. And one of the things Tinsley said, it was so hilarious. So when I started going to 8111 a couple years ago, I started talking about the solution. I said, there are five things we do to stay sober. And I'll be dogged if Tinsley didn't bring those up at this NARC meeting we were at a few weeks ago. And I'll ask him afterwards, where did you hear about the five things? He said, well, I'm pretty sure he said my sponsor, you know, went to 8111 and heard that. And I'd been talking about the five things we do to stay sober, which I'm going to tell you about before the end of this hour, and if you don't already know. And Tinsley said his sponsor had gone to 8111 and brought those back. And I said, well, that's funny because I picked those up at NABA, you know, 10 years ago and have carried the five things with me. It's basically we go to meetings, we call our sponsor, we work the steps, we work with others, and we pray to a God or meditate or have some sort of devotional time or quiet time. I'd like to touch briefly on my very southern traditional childhood. I was raised the third child of four by a Baptist and a Methodist mother and father. We went to church every Sunday and Wednesday. I learned how to act very responsibly. Yesterday we were at Jimmy Carter's church, and the lady had to take a whole hour ahead of time while we were waiting on him to come in to tell us how to behave. And I was there with one of my sponsees and my husband and one of her friends, and we both agreed, well, we didn't need to be instructed on how to act. We knew how to act, but there's a lot of people that don't. So that was a wonderful experience. I suggest it's a road trip you might want to take. But as beautiful and wonderful as my childhood was, I do want to say one thing that came up for me quite often is it seemed to be, and this wasn't my parents' fault, it's just the way things were, it seemed to be a shame-based household. You didn't talk about certain things, and later on you'll see how this created a pattern of thinking and denial of the truth that was very harmful to me and my family. And the 12 steps helped me break free of that. One of my first memories is I was having an appropriate 2-year-old tantrum, and I can see my mother and my grandmother towering over me with their hands on their hips. My grandmother probably had pursed lips, and they said, look at her, always has to have her own way. And the other one said, I know it. You know, it was just instilled, it was that Protestant, hard-working, we're not going to talk about anything real, we're going to go to church and everybody's going to think everything's great, you know. And for the most part, it was. In my teenagehood, the pervasive sense of separateness and loneliness that I had always felt seemed to increase. I wondered, you know, why aren't these cheerleaders inviting me to cheerlead with them? Why aren't, you know, the popular guys paying any attention to me? Why do I feel so different? You know, there was just this pervasive sense of separateness, and the 12 steps corrected that. I can't wait to tell you how. But this was what pervaded my teenagehood, is this sense of separateness. And when I had my first drink at age 14, it's a long story, so I won't go into it, but the first drunk I had, I remember I exaggerated. I wanted to get drunk like everybody else, so I faked drunk. I mean, that's sick, you know. But it took me years, you know, to admit that. I was so deeply ashamed of that. I wanted to have that first, you know, good drunk like y'all did, you know, but I didn't. I faked it. But the second time I drank, there was this tremendous sense of, oh, relief. You know, now I fit in. And our parents were very religious, so we had to sneak and hide. And when I look back on that, I think I can't believe they didn't know we were coming home drunk. I mean, we'd come home barely able to walk, and somehow we just got away with that. I think it was just the family, you know, turning away from that which was painful and just hoping, you know, that everything would turn out okay. And I'm happy to say it did. So that was how I drank in college. It's interesting because I'm helping my 17-year-old apply to colleges now, and I can drive myself crazy trying to control. He needs to get that essay in, you know, and then I have to remember back, well, nobody helped me apply to college, and, you know, it'll get done. Just let him do it. And so I've actually kind of used my sponsor to help me detach from all that process. But I went away to college. I came here to Atlanta. I went to Agnes Scott College. And I don't know if anybody in here remembers, but we were a women's college, And we used to hang out at Georgia Tech. And I don't know if any of y'all in here know this, but they used to have something called Open Rush. And that's where it was just this huge multiple block party. And they had giant trash cans, those big gray trash cans. They're huge. You know what I'm talking about. They hold the 30-gallon black sacks, like that one in the back there, that would be filled with this stuff called rocket fuel. And I was a bit naive. We had always we usually drank beer in high school, and I knew, you know, three beers will get me good and drunk. And but all it takes is about, you know, that much of the rocket fuel to get you equally drunk. But the problem is, I'd already had the whole glass by the time I knew, oh my God, I'm drunk, you know. And so I got into this pattern of going to these parties and waking up and sort of cracking one eye open and wondering, where am I, you know. And and that's just something that happened that I learned to not talk to anybody about. It was very disturbing that I would wake up and not know where I was, and I just shamefully rode the MARTA home or back to the dorms at Agnes Scott and didn't talk with anybody about it, and felt a deep sense of, you know, something, I think something might be the matter with me. It didn't occur to me, you know, that I had an allergy to alcohol, that when I had one drink and got a little tipsy, I wanted another one. This is a phenomenon of craving they talk about in the doctor's opinion. My daughter, who's 19, recently went to Europe with her father, and she said, oh, I had some wine. She said, I didn't like it. She said, it made me, I felt sick to my stomach. I just felt like I wanted to go back to the hotel room and lay down. In fact, that's what I did. And I said, oh, babe, you got to push past that, you know. So I learned, you know, that she didn't have the same reaction to alcohol that I had. That's what college was like for me. When I was a junior, I wish I could stand up here and tell you that I went into the field of I'm a physician, that I went into the field of medicine because I like to help people. That noble sense of wanting to do good in the world, but it's not the case at all. I went to medical school so I'd matter. See, when you feel insignificant, you got to do things to matter. So I went to medical school to distinguish myself, you know. The most unwholesome reasons, actually. My parents, we grew up a little on the poor side, and they were always fighting about money, and I thought, well, that's one way to make sure that never happens, you know. And so I went to medical school. I used very, very responsibly during medical school. You just simply can't miss class and make it through. So I learned, that was when I established this pattern of drinking primarily on the weekends. Friday and Saturday nights were my time to drink and do other things. By the way, I really do appreciate the singleness of purpose, and I'm here to tell you about my story with alcohol. There is one part of it where I am going to have to talk about drugs, and you'll see that it's, I think, pertinent to all of us, but I'm going to focus primarily on alcohol. So in medical school, I drank very responsibly and used drugs highly responsibly, and got married when I was a senior in medical school to a man named Norman, and I went on and did my anesthesia residency. Now, during anesthesia residency, it didn't occur to me that normal people don't have these thoughts, but I kept scheming of ways, you know, like nitrous oxide. I could take a tank of that home, you know. And I never did, but, you know, I'm scheming and thinking about that. And my life seems to be focused around, you know, planning that party for Friday night. And if it could be with, you know, other responsible people, you know, that would be responsible to bring the queso dip, we'll have a margarita night, you know. And that was just, and it was, you know, it's a chance to be creative, you know. And I that's how we partied. Now, I went to New Orleans for American Society of Anesthesiologists meeting one year, and I was drinking those hurricane things they have, and I remember going down from my purse, and I remember never coming up, you know. So come on, yeah. And I found out later I was pregnant with my first child during that, you know, drunken weekend, and didn't drink during my during the pregnancy. Is 10 months, by the way, not 9 months, but so I didn't drink for 9 months during that last the last 9 months of my pregnancy, and I thought, well, you know, if I can go 9 months without drinking, then the alcohol couldn't be a problem. My husband and I, Norman and I, found ourselves in counseling. I kept thinking, you know, I'd married the wrong guy, because we were seeming to fight a lot, disagreeing a lot on basic things. And of course, I didn't tell any of the counselors that I was drinking on the weekends. I didn't tell any of the counselors of any of the other things I was doing on the weekends, because I didn't think that was the problem. I thought he was the problem. You know, Norm's the problem. And this various, so we'd been from counselor to counselor to counselor. Nothing was working. We had our second child in 1995. Finally, this very astute counselor named Chuck Bancroft up in Gainesville, he talks like this. But he said to me, he said, Anna, I think you're an alcoholic. And I said, you know, me? What about this guy? He drinks a lot more than I do. He drinks every night. I just drink on the weekends. And I see this guy was real smart. He said, well, Anna, you know, most people that aren't alcoholic don't have to delegate their drinking until after 5 p.m. or until this day of the week. He said, do you like Brussels sprouts? Yeah, I like Brussels sprouts. You know, how often do you eat them? I said, I don't know, 8-10 times a year. You know, he said, do you plan your Brussels sprouts? No. You know, he said, see, you're neutral on Brussels sprouts. You see, now, you're not neutral on alcohol. So I said, oh, my God, I've allowed this terrible thing to happen. I've allowed myself to become an alcoholic. I'm going to quit drinking. Well, gradually things got worse, as it says on page 5 of the, you know. I didn't do anything to fix what was really broken inside, which was the way I was looking at the world, the way I was living in the world, the way I felt separate from you. It's so neat to look out at y'all tonight and see one big humanity. But it took me having to go through everything and work the steps to see that, you know, really. I mean, you know, 14 years ago, I'd be thinking, I'd be thinking in a paranoid way, why are all these people staring at me? You know, my thinking's sick. Left to my own devices, my thinking deteriorates very quickly into sickness. So I mustn't be left to my own devices, which is why I have to do the 5 things. So he said, you know, Anna, you're an alcoholic. I was desperate enough, hurting enough, lonely enough in my own marriage, the mother of 2 young children, that I believed him, and I stopped drinking. And it didn't take long at all before I sought relief from other things, primarily anesthesia drugs shot through an IV apparatus. I'm a very responsible IV addict, and I don't want to spend a lot of time talking to that, but I thought if I just use a little bit, 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there, and I never escalate my use, and I don't use every day, you know, then I'm just getting the relief that I deserve, because, dang it, you know, I've got a lot on my plate here. And so I did that for about a month, and I got very scared, and I told my brother what I was doing. Well, this was back in 97 when the Internet was coming up, and he looked it up, and he said, Anna, this is bad. What you're doing is bad. You know, hardly anybody recovers from that. He said, I think you need to go to NA and AA. And I remember going to my first AA meeting with him. I didn't pick up a white chip because I had worked the steps in my head. Why would I need to pick up a white chip? So I worked the steps in my head. It was Bob's birthday that night, and everybody kept talking about Bob this and Bob that and how wonderful Bob was. And Bob took some time up at the podium. I'm thinking, well, the heck with Bob. What about me? You know, I'm desperate here. And I couldn't relate. And I did not go back to that meeting and many others. Never did pick up a white chip. Had enough from those meetings to know, you really can't do what you've been doing anymore. So I white-knuckled it for several months. Sure enough, you know what happens when we don't work on ourselves. When we fail to enlarge our spiritual life, the disease progresses, and sure enough, that's what happened. And I'm thinking I'm doing fine. You know, it's been 5 months since I've done that. In June of 98, we had just moved offices. My children were raised in daycare, essentially, and my husband and I had to negotiate almost every day who's going to get the kids today. You know, you had to be there before 6. And so it was quite a bit of negotiation. We both had long commutes. Neither one of us had family here. It was quite a bit up in the air on any given day. We didn't have a lot of money to eat out because there were these huge student loans to pay back, so we tried to eat in. So that means somebody basically has to go to the grocery store every day or every other day. The women in the room know what I'm talking about, you know, when you're cooking for a family, you're out of cheese now, and you can't have tacos without cheese. And so there was quite a bit of negotiation, and there was one day where we were having dinner company on a weeknight, on a school night, and we had just moved offices, and I was really suffering in my own private hell, not being able to tell anybody because of the family constructs I'd been raised in, and I had been in the operating room that day, but I had not thought ahead enough to procure my drug of choice, and so I mixed up a crazy concoction of IV drugs. One of them was an animal anesthetic, and I basically gave myself a general anesthesia there on the bed with no anesthesiologist present except for me, and I was asleep, you know. And I woke up several hours later in a still under the influence in a stupor, enough awake to think, oh, my gosh, I've really goofed up. I picked up my phone. There were several frantic messages from Norman. Where are you? I don't know where you are. We've got company. I've picked the kids up. I've gone to the grocery store. Where are you? Please call. Several frantic phone calls. And I called him back and just, I mean, you know, that was at this point, I was so sick and tired of what I was saying on the outside not matching, you know, what was really going on the inside. And I really just, wanted to scream out, but I had to pretend, you know, like everything was fine. And so I lied and said, oh, I got tied up. And he said, no, that's not the case, but please just come home, you know. And I remember walking. I had to drive home in under the influence of a particular hallucinogen, which I had never done before. And it was just very, very scary. The clouds were, you know, coming out of the sky. And it was an awful, terrible feeling. And, you know, just it reminds me of when college I used to drive home with one eye covered under the influence of alcohol. So I'd see, you know, double instead of quadruple. It kind of reminded me of that. I'm doing everything I can, you know, to get home. And when I walked in, you know, children don't know. They're just glad to see. And I remember they ran up to me, and Norman introduced me to our dinner guests, and I shook his hand and had to pretend, you know, it's so nice to meet you. I'm so glad you're here. And, you know, on the inside, I'm thinking, oh, shoot, oh, shoot, oh, shoot. You know, I'm hardly ever get nauseated. I'm feeling nauseated as a side effect of one of the drugs I'd taken. Took one bite of food, had to run back, you know, to the bathroom. And as I'm throwing up, I'm thinking, you need help. And that was a loud enough cry for me to contact a local treatment center called MAR, Metro Atlanta Recovery Residences. And I don't think I'd be standing here without them. I've worked with lots of female sponsees over the time, some of whom have had treatment, some of whom have not had treatment. And I'm one of those that thinks our solution is found in the 12 steps. And I'm grateful that I went to MAR. I met my current sponsor through MAR, Paula. I thought I saw her come in, but oh, there she is. Yeah, I, you know, I wouldn't have Paula without Mark. I had a sponsor for the first 12 years of my recovery, and then she moved and wasn't available anymore, and couldn't find anyone to sponsor me. Everyone I asked said, "Nope, can't do it." And I wasn't even necessarily looking for someone with more time, but just a woman who knew about the steps. You know, that seemed to be kind of rare amongst the people I asked. Amongst the people I was around, so there's only a few women I could ask. And I remember calling Gigi Barnes over at MAR, and I said, I need a sponsor, you know. And she said, Ann, I don't know anybody, but if I think of someone, I'll call. And the next day she called, and Paula has sponsored me ever since. That was about a year ago, I think. So in any case, I went to MAR. I was still a liar when I went to MAR. They said, you know, you'd have to get a sponsor and you have to go to meetings. And so they said, Anna, 4 months later when I was ready to leave, well, first of all, I thought, now, I don't really need 90 days. I'm sure they'll see how smart I am and they'll let me go in 28 days, you know. So 4 months later, there I sat. And they said, you know, Anna, do you have a sponsor? Yes, I do. I have a sponsor. What's her name? Her name is Candace, you know. When's the last time you talked to her? I said, well, 4 months ago when I asked her to be my sponsor. You know, he said, no, that's not how it works. You have yourself a sponsor by tomorrow, by the time you meet tomorrow, or you can't leave. And I got Regina, my first sponsor that night, and had her for the first 12 years. I just randomly picked her, you know. And she knew the big book backwards and forwards. I think that's God doing for me what I can't do for myself. I remember being real insulted, Ewell Hardman was running the professionals program there. I had to turn myself into the board, and I had to let them know I'm in treatment for substance abuse. And so they said, okay, you do what Mar says, and then we'll talk about getting your license back later. And so I said, okay. So they had made a mistake on my medical record, and to me this was the most, you know, egregious thing. And so I kept trying to get them to correct this. No, I didn't do those drugs. I did these drugs. I mean, what difference did it make, really? But so I was trying to get them to correct this, And there's something called a GAF score, Global Assessment of Functioning. And most people operate at an 80 or above in the normal life. Most of y'all in here, you know, if you're operating at a pretty high level. If you're maintaining a job and you've got a place to live, you know, most people are doing pretty good. Well, I looked and he said that I had a GAF of 35, and I said, 35, you know, and I just remember being so insulted. I can only appreciate in retrospect, you know, how very sick I was. I was so used to just doing what it took to make it through the day, you know, and I think he was right. My GAF score was, my thinking was distorted. I worked steps 1, 2, and 3 in recovery, or in the treatment center. I expected to come out, and my sponsor said, okay, we'll pick up at step 4. She said, no, we're going to go back to step 1. So she made me read the forewords, you know, how this is a textbook that tells us how to live. She made me find the little pearls in a doctor's opinion that says our disease is twofold. One, we have a physical allergy of the body, whereby when we take a drink, we don't have the same reaction my daughter Hannah did. We say, well, you know, I need another one. You know, a phenomenon of craving gets set up. And then it's characterized by the mental obsession. And so she made me, you know, painstakingly, I mean, there was sometimes she'd be talking and I just, oh, I've heard all this before. I know all this. I've already read all these books on recovery. And she made me just listen. You know, I had to learn to be patient and listen. When it came time to work step 4, we worked up, you know, there through page 59 where the third step prayer is, and we read through the first part of how it works, how to make your four-column inventory. And she said, okay, Anna, I want you to list out all the people with whom you have resentments. I said, what do you mean? She said, you know, the people that you, just when you think about them, you think, oh, he needs to be punished, you know, and she shouldn't have got away with that. And I said, oh, good, you know, a chance to finally tell someone how the world has screwed me over. And I promptly put down 100 people on that list. I went all the way back to kindergarten. That's as far back as I could remember. So I had 100 people there in column 1, you know, and I couldn't wait to tell her all about column 2, why they had, you know, how they had hurt me, how they had betrayed me, how the world was unfair to me. And then column 3, and it profoundly affected me. I'm a very sensitive person. And it affected me personally. It affected me emotionally. It affected me financially, you know, and I just put down column 1, column 2, column 3, just like that, just like she'd asked. And then she said, okay, now we're going to do the fourth column. I said, all right, you know, you mean me put more people down? You know what? You know, what's the fourth column, you know? And she said, the fourth column is putting aside the wrongs others had done us. We resolutely look for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and fearful? Not were we. Of course, if they said, were we selfish, I'd have said, no. You know, it was Bob that goofed up, not me, you know. But she said, no, we're going to look at a turnaround on each one of these resentments. And I'd like to take you through that process, a couple of processes like that that really helped me. One was, it really didn't hit home till a few years later, but I had always had a secret resentment against all the cheerleaders of the world. Because, you know, and I hated them because they looked so good, you know, and they did their little moves, you know, and they left me out. And so when my daughter was in third grade, my children were 3 and 5 when I got in recovery. So a couple of years later, you know, she said, you know, Mommy, I want to be a cheerleader. I said, okay, what do we do? She said, here's a piece of paper, you know. You got to go try out. And all of a sudden it hit me. I've carried this resentment all these years, thinking that they were leaving me out. But you had to go try out. See, nobody was leaving me out. My thinking around it was distorted. And so it's been real neat raising kids in recovery and sort of learning about, through my own childhood experiences, you know, and wanting hers to be very different. You know, I took her to try out, you know. I'd gone through the turnarounds, you know, where had you been selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and fearful. And almost always, you know, the selfish thinking is, I want all the attention on me, you know. That's usually the selfish thinking. The self-seeking behavior often was this. It was, you know, my husband would say something to make me angry, and I'd shut him out with a book, whether I was studying, you know. And he said, you know, what are you doing? You're acting abnormal, you know. And I said, well, yeah, do mine. I'm studying, you know. So I'd learned to sort of keep people away in various ways, and that was a big one for me. The dishonest thinking is almost, you know, it was some variation on holding people to a higher standard than I myself had been able to live up to, or it was just my thinking was wrong, and my sponsor had to point that out. And then the fear is, I've worked with 25 or 30 women over the years, and I've learned that we all have the same basic fears. We all have the same six or eight basic fears. But if my sponsor had said to me, you're a very fearful person, and you're prideful on top of that, I'd have said, you know, to heck with you, please leave. I don't need anybody else correcting me. But the fourth and fifth step allowed me to discover what these fears were, what these defects were. Now, there was a man on my resentment list, a man named Tom, and he had abused my brother. He was a pedophile, and he had abused my brother from the time my brother was 11 until he was about 18. And the first time I saw my father cry was when Tom was finally arrested, and my parents realized, you know, who this family friend had been. And he was on my resentment list. Column two was that he'd hurt my family, he'd stolen my brother's childhood, he had betrayed my parents' confidence. Column three was it affected me in all kinds of ways. And, you know, and that was a real strong resentment. I thought if I could just get my hands on him. You know, I mean, I had all kinds of detailed plans. That's what I was going to, you know. And I remember getting drunk in bars, and I'd find a woman that was maybe laughing at my jokes like you are, and I would hook up with her, and we would talk. We would get to talking, and I would convince her, you know, that this was just the worst thing, you know, that could happen to a person. And just getting people on my side, you know, and they hated Tom too, and I felt right in my hatred for Tom. So I swear I didn't see how my sponsor was going to help me see how I was selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and fearful. I didn't understand how not wanting my brother to be raped, you know, was anything selfish on my part. And my sponsor had wisely saved this one till the end. You know, I had 100 people on my resentment list, but each one of them had two or three resentments, so that was like 200 or 300 or 400 turnarounds, you know. And so this was the very, very last one. This was turnaround number, you know, 296. And it was such a profound moment of a shift in consciousness. I remember where I was sitting in the den when it happened. I said, I don't see how this is me being selfish. I refuse to see it. You're not going to make me, you know. No, you're not going to make me. And she said, Anna, we need to talk about your notion of selfishness. She said, you have a distorted notion of selfishness. She gave me an example. She said, if a plane goes down and there's only enough provisions for 5 people to survive, and there's 10 people on the plane, the 5 that survive maybe snuck a couple of almonds in their pocket. They didn't say, I'll share these 6 almonds I have with you 10 people. You know, they maybe kept them to themselves. She said, it's a survival instinct. We all have it. Get over. Look at her. Always has to have her. You know, get over that. So I thought, you know, oh, that sounds right. I can get with that. Okay. The self-seeking behavior. See, I never was able to get my hands on Tom. But she was able to help me see that the thinking, all the space he took up in my brain, was taking time away from my children, was taking time away from me engaging in higher activities. You know, I'm thinking about the revenge that he should have, that he should get. He should be punished. You know, and I used to pull this on my sponsor a lot. I said, I am convinced if I line up 100 people, that 99 of them are going to agree with me that this guy's terrible and needs to burn in hell, you know. And she, after about 20 or 30 of those, she said, quit bringing in the 100 people. We're talking about you. You know, it's just you and me here. Quit lining up 100 people to agree with you. So, you know, by this time I'd worked with her for a while, and I took, you know, I said, okay, you know, yes, ma'am. I've always been a very studious person. And so she was able to help me see that the self-seeking behavior was just the amount of thinking I was giving to Tom. The dishonest thinking, she said, have you ever done anything wrong? I said, yeah, but I mean, I've never raped anybody. And she said, well, you know, what have you done? And I said, well, I've stolen a lot of things. I love taking things and not paying for them. And I got arrested for it when I was 17 and kind of got, thank God they took me to jail or I probably would have continued down that path. But you know, I would steal things like pens and things like that later on. And she said, you know, God doesn't rank sin. You're either in God's will or you're not. You know, and in my mind, my sin had been down here and Tom's sin had been up here. And so he deserved more punishment, you know, than I did. And I was just able to hear the truth of that. You know, so the dishonest thinking was that God ranks sin. And the fear is that the world's just an inherently divided and malicious place. And no matter what I do, it's just a giant hellhole. And I've had enough recovery experience to know that it's just not true, you know, that the world is, in fact, a very beautiful place. And I remember at the end of that conversation, I just remember where I was sitting in the den there. All the lights were out. Everybody was in the bed. It was 8:30. I was staying up later than I normally did, you know. And a tear blinked down my cheek. And she said, you take away the pedophilia, and how different are you from Tom Holland? And suddenly I saw, you know, that just like I deserve God's grace and love, so did he. You know, and the truth is, he'd probably been abused. People don't just turn out like that. He'd probably, statistically speaking, he'd been abused in a most malicious way. And from that day to this, and Tom died about 4 years ago in jail, every time I thought of him, and this is just a gift of God coming through my sponsor, I said, Lord, I hope he's free. I hope he knows that he's your child and that he's deserving of your love. I wanted that for him, because if he didn't deserve it, I didn't deserve it. See? And so that was my turnaround on that. A few weeks later, I've got about 5 more minutes, I was, this physician was giving me a $600 or $800 basketball goal for free. You know, and she's telling me where she lives, and I realize she lives in one of these big mansions over here off the river. And the whole time she's telling me how to come to her house, where she lives, I'm realizing she lives in one of those big mansions that I've always wondered, who lives in those big mansions, you know. And the whole time she's telling me, on the outside, I'm saying, thank you very much, we'll be there at noon, I'll bring a truck and a couple of guys, you don't have to arrange anything. And on the inside, I'm thinking, why does she get to live in the big house? Why can't I live in the big house? You know, there's just this big resentment brewing. And I panic as I'm leaving. I think, oh, my God, the steps haven't worked on me. They haven't worked on me. I've done 300 turnarounds, and it's still, you know, the resentments are still there. And so I called Norman, and he doesn't think like I do. Even though he drinks heavily, he just doesn't carry resentment. He doesn't think like I do. And I said, oh, my God, you know, Norman, the steps haven't worked on me. You know, we're getting this free basketball going. I've got this big resentment. And I remember he said, I don't know, darling. Call your sponsor, you know. So I called Regina. He didn't know what to say. That's the thing. We have to appreciate that the people in our lives, they don't know what to do with us. We just have to appreciate that. I got into a discussion with my husband. I eventually divorced Norm, and now I'm married to a man named Mark who's over here. And on the way over, I said, oh, you know, this is the dining room table we're going to get. And he said, well, I don't particularly care for that dining room table. And I said, well, I like this dining room table. And I made a case for it, you know, why it was better. And he said, you know, I don't know what you want me to say. And I said, I want you to say you like that dining room table and we're going to get it. You know, so I'm still learning how to not have to make someone wrong, you know. And the truth is there's great beauty in deciding together which dining room table you get. So I'm still, you know, I'm still a work in progress. But I said, oh, my God, the steps didn't work on me. So I called Regina, and I said, I've got this big resentment, and I can't believe it. I don't want to do any more turnaround. She said, you don't need to do a turnaround, Anna. She said, what you need to do is step 6 and 7. She said, you're a jealous person. I said, yes, I'm a jealous person. That had been on my list of character defects. Oh, by the way, the fifth column. I was listening to the Joe and Charlie tapes, and I found out they were talking about the fifth column. I'm like, oh, my God, I've been leaving out a column. What's the fifth column? What's the fifth column? The fifth column, according to them, is the list of character defects and fears that come from that first four-column process. And so she said, you know, was jealousy in your fifth column? That's not what she called it, because I just discovered this recently, you know. And I said, yes, I am a jealous person. She said, are you ready to not be jealous? I said, yes, I'm ready to not be jealous, because it stands in the way of my usefulness to my fellow men. And she said, then you're ready to pray the seventh-step prayer. And I remember where I was on 285. I was in between Ashford Dunwoody and Shamley Dunwoody. And she said, "Dear, repeat after me, dear God, please remove from me the defect of jealousy and replace it with a gratitude for the gifts I've been given. The kind of brain I've been given, where I can take a test on electrical wiring and you'll say, oh, Anna's smart, I'm going to hire her. Well, I don't know how to wire a house. I'm going to burn the thing down, you know. And so I've just got the kind of brain that can do real well on tests, but it doesn't mean anything, you know. I could make an A on a test in recovery when I first went to MAR, but that still doesn't obviate the fact that my GAF was 35, you know. And so she said, please remove from me the defect of jealousy and replace it with a gratitude for what I have, and a knowledge that this life is a gift, you know, a gift, so that I can be of service to my fellow men. So I called my sponsor today and I said, I don't know, I've got to go speak at NAVA tonight. It's an honor to speak at NAVA, but it's being recorded and I want it to sound really good, you know. And I said, do you have any advice for me? And she said, you know, yes, Anna, you know, just realize you're not there to impress anyone, you know. And that's another form of fear and self, is to realize I've got to do something to impress you. But no, I've got to share with you my own experience, strength, and hope, so that I don't have to feel separate from you anymore. Isn't that a hell we live in? Feeling worse than, better than, separate from. So that's been my experience with step 6 and 7, you know, and all the defects that I've, you know, I wasn't one of those that said, please remove from me every single defect which stands in the way. You know, my sponsor had me doing one at the time because I still needed to hold on to some. I mean, I still hold on to some because it gets me through. Let's see. Step 8 and 9, I learned how to be financial. I'm just going to quickly tell you about Step 8 and 9. I learned how to have a wholesome relationship with money in Step 8 and 9. My sponsor had me start tithing off the top. I used to tithe if there was any money left over, you know, and there just never seemed to be any money left over. And so she had me start whenever a check came in, you know, 10% went in the plate, or it went to MAR, or it went to some charity. And that was just a corrective measure. There were things I did. I remember pulling out of a parking lot once and slamming into someone's car and thinking, oh, my God, and I drove off. You know, how do you make an amends for that? So I made an anonymous donation to MAR, and now when I go over there and there's several rooms with anonymous, I think, I wonder which one of these rooms is mine, because I'm now ready to have them put my name there, you know. You know, she just had me, you know, it was corrective action I had to take. You know, it was corrective action. It would just been easy to say, oh, we don't have it. You know, we've got two kids and all these student loans. But I took the action, and sure enough, you know, it changed my relationship with money. Step 10 is a mini 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Step 11 is how we discover what we could have done better that day, because we pray about it. And then step 12 is working with other women. So the five things we do, I'm looking through the room, and there's several women in here that I've had just the privilege of getting to know over the years. I love each and every one of them. And it's such a blessing to work with them, because, you know, I'm telling, well, you're not going to enough meetings. And then I realize, well, I haven't been to a meeting in 2 weeks, you know. So I get up and I go to a meeting. I go to the 6:15, you know. To bear witness to another's awakening is a tremendous gift. And in doing so, hold on to what was so freely given to me by Regina and now Paula. And so that's how the 12 steps work for me. If you don't think you have the best sponsor ever, fire her and get another one, you know, and use the template of the steps as they're outlined in the big book. Do a thorough 4-column inventory and get a good, using the 5th column, get a good list that you can. I love step 6 and 7. Those are the hinge steps. See, that's where we let go of everything that's been keeping us trapped in 100 forms of fear and self, and the small mind, and the constant rumination of why are all these people still staring at me, you know. And we become liberated. And we don't have to worry about what other people think, because we know we're free, you see. So I encourage you to use the steps in that way, and in doing so, liberate yourself and the people around you. Thank you for your attention, and I look forward to seeing you again.
Tinsley, correct again. Nice pick. Thank you very much. Anna, that was a great story.
First I slip, and then I crib to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart. Takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something to set me free. Where the promises are.